General Cooper, Reel 4. So the Abyssinia crisis seemed not like a crisis to those of you who were actually on the spot.
No, it didn't. And I say, we patrolled the frontier, and as far as we could see, we never saw any movement by the Italians in their so-called forts, which were sand dunes dug in well behind the frontier, in a visible distance. And indeed we used to wave, and sometimes we used to throw them cigarettes. To keep them cheerful.
Sounds a bit like the Christmas truce in 1914, doesn't it?
Yes. And then we had a little fun with the Navy, because Mersin Matruh was some distance from Saloum, 100 miles, might be more. It was more planning with them. They brought in I've forgotten the name of the ship. All I do remember, we used to call it HMS Makewater. Merely because water was pretty scarce up there, and they used to make water and give it to us. But it was merely planning so that if we did have to move up to the frontier, they could support us from the sea if necessary with supplies, or indeed cover us with fire.
At least the Abyssinia crisis had the effect of concentrating a larger number of RTC units in this area, and from that to the development of the Mobile Brigade. Was much opportunity taken of this concentration for you to train as a brigade in the desert?
Oh, very definitely, yes.
What kind of things did you do?
Ordinary brigade training of all arms, either in columns or defending, taking up positions against possible lines of attack, because your lines of attack have to be fairly, rather like roads in England, because the country for large forces comes to that. And you've got soft going, hard going, escarpments, which confines you. And there was only one road. But even the deserts, there are places where you can't maneuver, and so you could find your reconnoitre your the positions which, if the Italians did advance, then we could block them. We knew roughly where, not where, but where the possible places of advance were. And we did operate, and it helped. Not only in the actual tactics in the field or in the desert, but also, of course, the great problem of supply. And
how did it help in the problem of supply? Because that always was the problem in that theater, wasn't it?
In that we would move out, but true, of course, was purely our sort of base for ease of administration. But of course, as soon as you move out, you've got to go into the desert in various blobs over a vast area, and then, of course, you taught your B echelons, which is your administrative echelons, to bring up supplies at night, and they've got to be taught how to get to you and drive in the dark without lights, and you've got to refuel at night without lights. And ammunition were brought up, and all that. And that training went on the whole time.
Were you at this stage using the system that was applied in the later North African campaigns of World War II of creating supply dumps at various stages?
No. No. We had it in mind that you'd have to do that, our resources were limited and to actually do it in peacetime.
Was any of the experience and training you did during this period directly relevant in application to the to the World War II campaigns in North Africa?
Well, of course, the whole initial training, of course, they had more training and developed it further with larger forces later on, in 38, when they formed a division up there. But it certainly formed the basis for that further development of larger forces operating in the desert.
What about the mapping?
Well, the mapping, of course, that started before this, because we in six tanks, we used to each, I think it was about spring, used to go out for about a month or 6 weeks with a small group of about 12 vehicles, no tanks or armored cars, purely lorries and a staff car. We used to go out into the western desert and take various routes and map out the country in what we called good going, bad going, as we saw it. And that built itself up each year. One year we did one part, another year we did another part. And then, of course, that got filled in as more troops were out in the desert, and then they filled it in, more units, rather. Mm. And indeed, I think it was in 36, but I'm not sure, when the new commander-in-chief, General Gordon Finlayson, came out and took over command. In fact, I think that we were out in the western desert, and on our way home, and we had a message to say we were to hold and wait for the commander-in-chief and his, I suppose it was probably his BGS ops, who came out to us because he wanted us to show him the frontier down to the Katara Depression.
How did that go?
That went very well. We met him, and we took him in our things. I nearly got him lost one day, because we sent back, he was particularly looking at some ground, and of course there'd been a certain amount of tracks up there by this time with all the units freaking about, and we'd sent back our supply lorry to set up camp for him and get his dinner ready. And I thought I knew the way, and I got led astray by a damn track and didn't stick to my compass and navigation, because he was pressing behind. It was getting rather late. And eventually I had to say, "General, stop. I've made a nonsense of this. We can either go north to the Mediterranean, which is going to take us some time, and I don't know if we've got enough petrol to get there, or we go due east, we hit the Nile." And I might say he was very good, and he said, "Well, you sit down and try and work it out which you want to do." But I had a bit of luck then. I got down to the basic facts of navigation, moved off, drove about a mile, and thank God I suddenly saw the light of our camp.
You told me last time that General Finlayson actually made a contribution to this particular survey.
Oh yes, he did, because it was as a result of his reconnaissance that the broad outline of what became the Alamein line in the war, that he laid out in very broad detail, of course, as the last stopping place before the Delta. And that was the between the Katara Depression and the Mediterranean.
Now, we were going to talk about light tanks, because 6RTR was in a period of conversion, and you did have some light tanks.
Yes, we had some light tanks came out to us, I should say half a dozen. three-man light tanks. We had some two-man light tanks for reconnaissance purposes, but in England they'd been developing the three-man light tank. And I suppose because of the Abyssinian trouble brewing up, they thought this was an opportunity to try out this three-man tank in the desert quickly, and because if it had brewed up, they want to know the results. So they came out, but of course they hadn't got any mountings for the Vickers gun. They just got a hole. And so we were shot up to the desert in the autumn of 35, and we took these with us. The one thing that we were impressed upon us was that we must not allow any, if possible, anybody else to see these were three-man light tanks, because the Germans were building the two-man light tank and had their contracts out. We didn't want them to think that we were discarding the two-man light tank for the three-man, and they might convert or stop it. We wanted them to go ahead and build as many two-man light tanks as possible. So we had to move very carefully, dark, and keep them covered up, because a lot of Germans in Cairo, and of course to get up to the Western Desert you've got to go through Cairo. So that was one problem. And I think, as far as my memory serves, I don't think they ever got an inkling of it at that time. Of course, we only had half a dozen, so it would have been, wasn't very difficult. But the difficulty, the worst thing, of course, was when we got to the Western Desert, which was this hole. You drove around it, and that hole where the gun was just where your tank commander stood. And of course, he got tummy ache because of the cold wind in the early morning blowing through the hole. So we had to stuff that up with some cardboard. But then when we started to patrol the frontier, we thought, these Italians are going to see this. So we then got some broomsticks and a bit of metal and had a false gun stuck in there. And always took, as we went down the frontier, any three-man light tank always had its turret reversed to the west. So the Italians, they might see something, but we hoped they didn't notice it was a broom, and not a broom handle and not a gun.
How did these new machines stand up to desert conditions?
Oh, they were very good. The three-man light tank was a very good tank, and of course it made all the difference between control. We've got three-man where the commander, especially in the desert, to fight a tank and command it, with the navigation problem, the going problem, it was difficult. And the three-man, especially for the section commander, to be completely free, but he got a gunner and he could put all his attention to where his other four tanks were and that sort of thing. The three-man light tank was very good.
Mm. This would have been the Vickers light tank, would it?
Yes, the Vickers three, it was a Vickers meat, I don't know what they call it, a Vickers three-man light tank.
Yes. Mark something or other.
Mark something, Mark. Yes. Four, I don't remember.
Yes. Well, it sounds remarkably fortuitous that the first machines to come out, actually, you had no bugs with.
Oh, very little. They were very good. Mm. As far as I remember, they behaved very well.
You mentioned the conversion of the 8th Hussars to motor vehicles. How did you personally become involved in this?
Well, we were in the same barracks in Abyssinia. The 8th Hussars were there, and we were in the same barracks. We only had two companies in the barracks, and they had their whole regiment in the barracks. We had one company up little in the same area in Abyssinia, but it was in a different barracks. And that only consisted of us running classes for them in driving and maintenance and gunnery. Not so much gunnery, but because, of course, they knew the Vickers machine gun, because they had those themselves. But Of course, they had to learn it not from a static mounting, from a mobile mounting and that sort of thing.
It strikes me that the process of converting a cavalry unit from horsed transport to motor vehicles, with the kind of previous experience that the men in the regiment, cavalry regiments, would have, must have been rather tricky.
Well, no, you know, it, you see, very largely the tactics and that sort of thing was very much the same. Of course, the vehicles were not. At the same time, they were very used to grooming their horses, so therefore they quickly learned that when the tank, we had to explain to them it wasn't a private motor car and that your vehicle had to be groomed too. They soon got that. Some of the officers didn't, perhaps. They thought they could push it in the garage and lock the door and then drive it out the next day, because they were Ford trucks, they weren't tanks. They quickly learned that when you came home after exercise, you had to go over your tanks just like you did with a horse.
So your difficulties were more with the officers than with the men, were they?
I should think so. The junior officers.
Yes.
Some of them, not all of them. They quickly got to it, and they enjoyed it. Because it wasn't a tank, and it was great fun to go out in the desert and drive these Ford trucks over the sand dunes. It was a challenge, and they soon took to it.
Did you get the impression of any regret or sentimental loss which the cavalry units felt at the loss of their horses?
No, not really. I think the things became too quick. You see, after all, they only converted in, I think it was about, well, they weren't fully converted until I think 38. And then, of course, the war came in 39. Mm-hmm. They had their regrets that they didn't have their horses in a way, but they still had their polo.
In 1939, you went to Staff College at Camberley. Did the RTC get a reasonable share of places at Staff College?
Well, they certainly did when I went in 39, because there must have been at least six of us, which was a very good proportion. That may have been slightly due to the fact that the DMT, who had a lot to do it, was General Hubbard. And, of course, one must remember that the cavalry were converting, and they were busy doing that, and hadn't the experience for staff training in armoured or mobile warfare that we had. And so there, that brigade, I suppose, was a strong point for us to have. That 39 course, I say, I think was at least six officers of the RTC there.
So General Hubbard was looking after his own, as it were.
Well, I think he was, but being General Hubbard, what he was looking after was the army to make up for lost time.
Yes. In the staff training course that you had, there was a section on arms of the service. In that section, how much attention was directed specifically towards the corps, the tank corps? It'll be the armoured corps by now, wouldn't it?
No, the Army Corps wasn't formed until the war started.
Ah, I got my dates mixed up then.
I don't think I can remember. There was nothing specific to the Royal Tank Corps. But, of course, there was a tremendous attention paid to march tables and movement tables of mobile forces, because staff officers do have to time them and get your march tables accurate. Otherwise, of course, you can't maneuver large forces about. You'll get them all crisscrossing and road jams, and you had to work all that out and get that side of it right. Mm. And there's quite a bit of that done. because that had not been done before.
With the Staff College being the sort of university of the army, and the sort of intellectual focus, if you like, of the army, did you study much in a general kind of way, relevant to your own arm, the tank corps?
You obviously, before you ever went there, of course, you've got to pass the exam. And that is quite a stiff exam. It was a very stiff exam in those days. And so, of course, you had to do a tremendous amount of reading. And, of course, we didn't do too much reading, because we probably read Little Hart and all those sort of people and Fuller, etc., in our normal way. And so, of course, one was inclined to, at least I was, to concentrate on studying other arms, because it's no good having a first-class knowledge of your own arm and no other arm. As a staff officer, you've got to know all arms and administrative services.
But I'm mainly interested in the tank corps, as you know, so I'm going to press this point a little bit. Do you think Fuller and Little Hart and the theoreticians were widely read within the tank corps and were influential in the formulation of your ideas?
Oh, yes. Without doubt they were. And anybody who certainly went to the Staff College certainly read them and discussed them and argued about them. We didn't agree with everything they said, by any means.
What kind of controversies were created by some of the things they said amongst professionals like yourself?
Well, I think of course, Little Hart's one of the controversies with him, of course, was he was a bit too much on defense. And we said, no, arm is much more attack. He was, by that I mean he was getting away from trench warfare, but he was very much a defensive-minded man. He had a fence in a way, but generally speaking, I think we did feel there he did too much. Oh, I can't remember the others. They're really niggling bits of pieces according to the book, you know, as you read it and talked about it in the mess and that sort of thing. You take it up.
How did the influence of people like Little Hart, Fuller and so on compare with the influence of the senior officers in the tank corps? I mean, were you getting many of your ideas from outside the corps, or was the bulk of the thinking of the corps directed by senior officers within it?
Oh, senior officers within. That was a great. They were the people. And getting out from Hobo, from the armored forces, and this brigade in England, Broad in the first instance, and then of course Hobo, when he had the mobile brigade, and it was very largely them. And John Crocker, who was Hobo's brigade major, and those thinking chaps.
Had
the experience of the First World War.
Mr. Little Hart does tend to represent himself as the ideas man in armour, as if he's sort of pulling the strings and laying down the lines. And I've often wondered whether many of his claims about being the primary leader in the thinking about the use of armour were justified, whether in fact professionals did pay as much attention to him as he claims that they did.
I would think that perhaps people like Hobo certainly mentally used him, because they did see each other quite a lot. And there's no doubt that Little Hell did have some ideas, and in fact was full of ideas. And of course, wrote so well and helped to spread the gospel, as you might term it, as a gospel, because that's really what it was, the teachings of Broad, who followed on from Fuller, of course, and who was a very great man, I think, in this armored warfare. He was done down, I think, at the beginning of the war. He could have been done, he made much greater use of him, been sent off to India. I think Little Heart did produce a lot of ideas, and was a great help. But he wasn't the lone wolf by any means, and he didn't produce them all by any means.
Well, during this period, when you worked very close to General Hubbard as his G2 in the formation of the 11th Armored Division, what sort of man was he like to work for?
He was a tremendous driver. You were flat out all day and every day. He was never wanting for ideas, for thoughts. He was always a step ahead of everything. And he was the actual leader and was a great man to work for. A hard taskmaster who didn't suffer fools gladly, who you had to stand up to. The one thing he couldn't stand was a yes man. If you said, yes, sir, well, I remember one time we were absolutely on our knees. He'd gone on too far. Mark you, he'd been hard tasked to produce the 11th Armored Division to repel an invasion in 6 months. That was his task, so he had to be. But we were absolutely down and out, and we couldn't continue any longer. And I remember talking to his G1, who was my boss, who was Mackerson, Colonel Mackerson. And I said to him, look, he's got his staff out. We've got to stop. What are we going to do about it? He didn't know. Eventually, Mackerson said, well, I know what we'll do, George. We'll say yes, sir, no, sir, to everything he says. I said, good God. Do you really mean that? He said, yes, I think that would probably do the trick. So every time he called me in and asked me a question, so I did, yes, sir, no, sir. He took this for one morning, and in the afternoon he came round the offices, and he said, George, I think it's time you went had 48 hours leave. Mark you, you better go away this weekend. Mark, you Saturday morning came, I didn't go. But he couldn't stand yes and
yes. Of course, he had a great reputation in training armoured forces, and you in this position would have seen his methods. What kind of way did he work? Could you give me a little insight into that?
It's very difficult to say how he worked. It was his knowledge and his way of putting that across to commanding officers of regiments, brigade commanders, and the way he ran his exercises. We would have four exercises on the tape, as you might term it. One in outline, which he'd outlined and you were developing, one which has got to the next stage, and one which had gone to the further stage, and one which was the final stage, and was probably beginning to take place actually on the ground with the troops. And he never let up. And he could keep all those going and keep them separated in his mind, wherever he was, whoever he was dealing with. And the one exercise developed, that was his great thing, was he never jumped ahead. He brought the troops or the training up right through it. He never skimped anything, and he didn't put on an exercise that was that missed out a step. At the same time, he always kept the carrot, or made you go for something a little bit more than you were ready for. So you were always pressing ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, and of course his knowledge and what you learned was nobody's business.
He also had a reputation of being a bit abrasive as well. Did you see much of this side of him?
Well, I saw him getting rid of one commander who happened to be my instructor at the Staff College, one of my instructors at the Staff College. And I found it very awkward because I was called into his office with this lieutenant colonel when he sacked him, told him he was no good. And he turned to me and said, "George, what do you think about it?" And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, sir, I have to agree with your remarks of what he said." And this was a late instructor of mine. He was a very clever chap, but he just wasn't a commander
mm-hmm.
in this particular instance. Mm. But he had no hesitation
yes.
in having him up and saying exactly what he thought. And why?